here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, have you ever slowed down when a car is tailgating you just to make that other driver annoyed? A psychologist joins the show to tell us why spite is part of our daily lives. First, the killing of George Floyd, along with police shootings before and after his death last year, have the issue of qualified immunity back in the spotlight. The legal principle protects police officers and other government officials from many civil lawsuits. A police reform passed by the U.S. House last month would largely do away with that protection that's currently being considered by the Senate. In the meantime, some city and state governments around the country are making their own changes to qualified immunity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should police be largely exempt from civil lawsuits? Do you see a middle ground on the issue? Also want to know how you came to your viewpoint on qualified immunity and policing. What experiences shaped your opinion? Did encounters with the police inform your views? Do you work in law enforcement yourself? Let us know your thoughts and maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Terry Ravenel is a professor of law and the associate dean of faculty research and development at Villanova University. Her areas of expertise include civil and criminal procedure and police conduct. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Terry, I gave a very brief definition of qualified immunity. Can you spell it out a little more for us? What do we mean when we talk about that?
Sure. I think that in order to have a really good understanding of qualified immunity, you have to understand what it's a defense to. So Section 1983, which is the full title, is 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, provides a civil remedy for the deprivation of federally protected rights, including constitutional rights. And one of the things that's really rather extraordinary about this statute is it allows regular people like you and me to bring a civil action against government officials who are acting under the color of state law and deprive them of a federally protected right, including a constitutional right. So it basically becomes the vehicle by which people can enforce constitutional rights. And the thing that's really amazing about it is it's not only a remedy that allows for monetary damages or compensation for actual injuries. Theoretically, it also allows a remedy for injunctive relief. And so that's sort of the basis of the statute, which is actually a Reconstruction era statute that was enacted back in 1871 following the Civil War. And then the qualified immunity doctrine is an affirmative defense to damages actions for violations of that statute. And so what qualified immunity allows a defendant to do is to basically say, yes, I did violate the Constitution, but even if I did deprive you of your constitutional rights, I didn't know that I was depriving you of your constitutional rights because the law wasn't sufficiently clear at the time that I engaged in the alleged conduct. And the court has reasoned that it is unfair to hold a government official liable for conduct that they, in fact, could not have known was unconstitutional at the time of the alleged behavior. And so that's sort of a nutshell version of both the civil remedy, 42 U.S. Section 1983, and the accompanied affirmative defense of qualified immunity.
Now, with that first part, what this code, this legal, this law means, a citizen could not only sue for damages, but also you said injunctive relief, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, means you have to pay me, but also you have to stop doing this thing. Is that about right?
So that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the statute on its face allows for a plaintiff to sue both for damages and for injunctive relief. And probably the best example of that is the city of is Floyd versus the city of New York, which was a case that was decided back in 2014. And what a class of plaintiffs did was that New York, particularly their street crimes unit, they alleged that New York police had a policy and practice of discriminating against Black and brown men, particularly men sort of in their mid-teens to lower 20s, and that they would stop them without probable cause. And so it was a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, but also because they were targeting them because of their race, that this was also a violation of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. So in addition to wanting damages for the past harms caused by these stops, they also wanted New York to change their policy and practice so that they no longer targeted young Black and brown men in this way. So that would be probably the best example of how it can both serve to compensate for past injuries, but also to prevent future injuries. The problem is, though, is that while the statute says that on its face, the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the statute is that there has to be a standing requirement. And when I say that, what I mean is that the plaintiff has to have standing to bring that particular claim. And when it comes to a claim for injunctive relief, there has to be the threat of an immediate future injury. And so unless you can establish that there's a real risk that you're going to suffer the same injury again, then the court will hold that you don't have standing. So in a case where something like stop and frisk, where plaintiffs may actually be stopped multiple times, they're able to establish standing. In other cases, the case that actually established the standing doctrine was coincidentally a case involving a chokehold during a traffic stop. The court said there, well, it's unlikely that you're going to be stopped by police again, and that if you are stopped by police again, that they're going to use this chokehold absent any sort of provocation. And so you don't have standing to bring injunctive relief. You only have standing for the damages claim. And so it gets a little bit complex when you start digging into sort of the nuts and bolts of the doctrine. But the general idea is that Section 1983 is largely used for compensatory damages. So for those monetary actions, and that qualified immunity acts as a shield in those cases involving monetary damages.
Talking to Terry Ravenel, law professor at Villanova University, about qualified immunity, especially as it applies to police officers, what it means, where it came from, and the prospect, some calls to change that doctrine. You can join in with your thoughts on that and your questions at 800-642-1234. And Terry, you've mentioned qualified immunity came from this concept. It sounds like came from the U.S. Supreme Court. This is not something passed by Congress, signed by the president. It's the Supreme Court's interpretation of this law limiting it.
Yes, that's exactly right. As so many people have noted recently, qualified immunity is a judicially created doctrine. And so when you actually look at 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, and you can Google it and find it, but that's the statute that, again, provides the civil remedy for the deprivation of constitutional rights. And when you read through the statute, particularly when you read through it in its original language from 1871, there's absolutely no mention of any defenses. And so if somebody were just to pick up the statute, read it, you would assume that it provided liability in all cases. But what the court said, the statute essentially lay dormant for a number of years following the end of the Reconstruction era. And it wasn't until 1960 in a case called Monroe v. Pape, where people really started to use the statute again. And then shortly thereafter, in the late 60s, is when we see the Supreme Court actually acknowledge the defense of good faith qualified immunity. And at that point, the immunity actually looked a little bit different. It was called good faith qualified immunity. And what the court reasoned was that the immunity existed at common law when the statute was passed back in 1871. And although Congress didn't mention the immunity, this defense, when it passed the statute, that it intended to incorporate the defense. Now, that's been called into question, and I'm actually in the middle of an article right now that goes back and sort of considers this origin story of both the Civil Rights Act of 1983 and qualified immunity. But it's a question that's being studied a lot more lately. And in fact, Justice Thomas recently called into question the origins of the qualified immunity doctrine. And so a lot of scholars have been writing and thinking about, one, whether it was intended to be incorporated, and if so, what it should look like or what it did look like at common law.
We're talking to Terry Ravenel, professor of law at Villanova University, looking at qualified immunity, especially for police officers, and potential changes to those protections under a policing bill being considered by the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about qualified immunity, what it means, what it does? Do you want to see it changed, or do you want to see it stick around? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Terry Ravenel, law professor at Villanova University, looking at the principle of qualified immunity for police, what it means, how it affects policing, and some changes possibly in the works. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Terry, before we go to our callers, we've seen arguments that we need this qualified immunity, otherwise police are going to be exposed to frivolous lawsuits, might drive people out of the profession. Other people saying, no, this idea is being abused to protect police abuses. Where do you see it on that kind of continuum?
You know, I think that it's actually a little bit more complex than that. And it's a nuanced answer. And part of it depends on where you live in the country, quite frankly. What a recent study showed was that 99% of the cases in which police officers have been found liable, that the police officers are actually indemnified by their cities. And so when people talk about it, they're often talking about it in this very theoretical way. And that is, in fact, part of the justification behind the qualified immunity doctrine, is that that if we did not protect our public servants in this way, that they wouldn't be inclined to serve. But one of the things that we have to recognize is that there's actually other solutions besides qualified immunity. So one of the things that we could do, and in fact, which does happen in practice, is that government officials could be indemnified for their liability so that, in fact, they don't have to shoulder the cost. And this is what is actually happening in practice. And so there's actually, I think, a middle ground about what is truly the answer. And the truth is that we don't necessarily need to fear that people won't join the police force and serve in this way. But what we have to highlight is that if we take away qualified immunity, that there is some other shield, which is, in fact, indemnification.
I'm going to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Connor is with us in Madison. Connor, hi.
Yeah, this is Connor. I actually called this morning to kind of get into this issue a little bit, because I think you really offer an interesting solution in terms of indemnification being sort of a middle ground. But what concerns me about policing in this day and age is that we have this perception on one hand that there are good apples in the police and just a few bad apples doing bad things. My experience, however, has been very different. I've experienced a lot of bad apples in the police, and I've been sexually assaulted by police officers in Wisconsin and received really just kind of a dismissive attitude from the police department investigating that. So it seems to me that qualified immunity has been used as a shield for these officers to continue to abuse me and a few other people who have, you know, frankly, through the victimization, have gone on to kind of ruin their own lives.
And I'm sorry to hear that that's happened to you. Thank you for sharing your experience, though. Terry, Connor sees qualified immunity as a shield for bad, in this case, he's claiming illegal behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we start talking about police violence, bringing lawsuits against the police. It's a really complicated subject matter, and qualified immunity is only one small piece of it. Establishing an underlying constitutional violation often requires evidence of a harm. And with things like the blue wall of silence and a lot of other sort of questions about how you establish that and questions of credibility when you have somebody who is testifying against a police official are really complicated. I tend to agree with Connor that I think that we often try to make it a question of good police versus bad police. And I think that that's an unfortunate way to look at it. And I think that it oversimplifies a really complicated area of the law. And I think that what's important to think about is not so much whether police are good or bad, but what is the best training that we can give police officials in order to prevent these types of constitutional deprivations from happening in the first place? And that's one of the things that when we're talking about police reform more broadly, that people are really thinking about these days, things like de-escalation, not using no-knock warrants, the use of chokeholds, different techniques, whether or not police should be sent during mental health crises, whether there's other alternatives. These are the types of broader questions that don't necessarily implicate individual wrongdoing, but force us to look at policing more systematically. And I think that one of the things that is very useful about indemnification, or what we might even take a step further and talk about as vicarious liability for municipalities, is that it gives municipalities a very clear incentive to start rethinking the policies around policing. And I think that so long as we have more transparency and the budget about the cost of settling these types of lawsuits, I think that's going to lead to better public accountability about how we engage in policing, which is a really important function of civilized society, but that we have to think very carefully about, because police do have enormous power, as some of Connor's experiences have shown.
Thanks for the call, Connor. I want to make sure I've got the thread right here, Terry. With this indemnification idea, it's yes, you can sue if your civil rights have been violated. The police officer, the individual, wouldn't be on the hook, but their department or their municipality or the local government. And that in turn would incentivize, if I run a city, I don't want to pay out lots of lawsuits like here. That's going to motivate me to change our patterns and practices. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. And, you know, one of the questions, too, is whether it's going to be indemnification or vicarious liability. Right now, we already operate on a system of indemnification. But whether or not a municipality is required to indemnify its officers can depend on a lot of different factors, like what the state statute at hand, if there's a police union contract that demands it. So that's why I said initially that it can vary a lot from place to place. Mm-hmm. But if we were to make a bigger move to vicarious liability, then we wouldn't have to sort of the question of whether or not the municipality would end up with the sort of financial burden would not depend on these additional factors, like police union contracts or indemnification statutes.
Let's go back to our callers now. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hello.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call. Great conversation. Came in kind of towards the end, so I didn't hear all of it. But I have some recent kind of statistics that I heard. 850,000 police officers in the United States, which kind of leads me to believe, in fact, they say the numbers are going up, that people aren't really dissuaded from going into law enforcement, which I actually think is good. I really do support law enforcement. Having been in the Marine Corps and having been schooled on excessive use of force, though, I heard some other statistics that were alarming to me, that in the last 10 years, 1,600 police officers were killed in the line of duty. Very tragic. In the last 15 years, over 16,000 Americans were killed by police officers, and only 7 police officers were held accountable of their actions. And that just seems so stark and so low that there has to be across the board federal accountability for what I seem to see as excessive use of force. And obviously, there's, you know, a whole continuum of whether or not a police officer is responsible in a specific situation. But those statistics, if they are accurate, you know, are very concerning. I guess I'd like your guest to speak to.
Gotcha, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Just a couple of minutes left. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, Terry, but Paul, concerned that there's not enough accountability when police use deadly force.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, again, a very complicated question, Paul. I did jot down some of the numbers that you were talking about. One of the things that makes all of this very complicated is that back in 2014, when we first sort of started really seeing a lot of media attention on police killing, that summer that Michael Ferguson was murdered or was killed by police, and there were several other police killings that summer, it became very clear that we didn't actually even have a national database where we were tracking how many civilians were killed by police officials. And the Washington Post at that point started their own database. But that actually just goes to show part of the problem in the sense of we haven't actually done a very good job identifying the problem. I also think that you're correct when we think about accountability, but accountability is questionable in the sense of, are we talking about criminal accountability? Are we talking about civil accountability? What does accountability mean if the police official doesn't pay civil damages and the municipality does? Does that mean that the police official wasn't held accountable? What if there's some sort of, you know, internal discipline? Is that accountability enough? I think that what we saw with Derek Chauvin's case, and one of the things that people highlighted, was that there hasn't been a lot of criminal accountability. It's very, very seldom that on-duty police officers are actually charged with police violence. And if they are charged, it's even more seldom that they're actually convicted of it. So there's a much larger question about accountability. And then there's also lots of questions about what is excessive force. The way that the Supreme Court has adopted the standard right now is what they've essentially said is that if an officer believes that the person poses a threat to the officer or others, that they are able to use force, and in fact, deadly force. And so when you sort of see that happening, what often ends up occurring is that the officer says, I feared for my life, and maybe they did it that moment. But what the court does not take into consideration are things like, could the officer have de-escalated the situation? So what I hope all this shows is that it's really complicated.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much to our guest, Terry Ravenel from Villanova University. Looking at the concept of qualified immunity, there's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, a veterans facility in Tomah was at the center of controversy over the prescription of opioid medications. Kate Archer-Kent checks in, look back at that problem and what's changed now at the VA Medical Center since then. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now tell me if you've done this before. You're driving on the highway, car tries to speed up to pass you, but you're annoyed. So instead of letting the car go in front of you, you speed up too, just to sort of block them. This is just one example of spite. Even though it often gets a bad rap, he says there are some benefits to spitefulness. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When do you feel yourself becoming spiteful in your daily life? Do you fight that urge sometimes? And what's it like when you're on the receiving end of good old-fashioned spite? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Simon McCarthy-Jones is an associate professor of clinical psychology and a neuropsychologist at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. He's author of the book Spite, The Upside of Your Dark Side. Simon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Well, I think we all, when we hear the word spite, might have an idea of what that means, or we might think of a particular person we've known. What is your working definition of spite for the purposes of our conversation?
So formally speaking, then, spite would be when you harm or inflict a cost on somebody else, but also harm or inflict a cost on yourself as well. One of the kind of the best examples probably from literature would be Captain Ahab, who is going to kill that white whale, whether it destroys him, his ship, his crew. That's a spiteful character.
And you talk about it as sort of the fourth behavior. There's cooperation, where you and I work together to help both of us. There's selfishness, where I harm you to help me. There's altruism, where I hurt myself a little bit. I pay a cost to help you. But then, yes, spite. It seems like it's inherently a negative thing. Just to make sure something bad happens to you, I'm willing to accept a cost for myself. But you say it's not always negative. Why not?
Well, very often it is negative. I'm sure we can go into the reasons why it's negative. But I suppose, first of all, just to say why it is particularly negative. I mean, if you think about what we as a species have as our core superpower, then you might well say that it's our ability to cooperate with each other to create these win-win situations, which has really allowed our species to kind of to populate the globe. Now, when you look at spite seems to be the exact opposite of cooperation. It's lose-lose. So spite would almost seem to be almost like human kryptonite. It threatens to undermine our species' superpower, which makes it potentially deadly. Now, in terms of the benefits, well, there's a few of these. So one thing is that the spiteful person seems to have a bit of a competitive edge. So in one study, people were asked to just add a series of two-digit numbers together, and they did that. And then they were asked to then do it when there was a prize on the line. And what they found was that everybody improved once the prize was offered, but the spiteful people improved twice as much as the non-spiteful people. So that desire of a spiteful person to get ahead seems to give them a slight competitive edge.
A lot of your work looks at this really deceptively simple game that psychologists came up with called the ultimatum game, where we're splitting some money up. Can you tell us, first of all, how this game works?
Sure. So this game came out of Germany in the 1970s. And what happens is you go into the lab and you're told there's somebody in the next room and they've been given $10 and they've been asked to share some of it with you. And you get a little note through the door saying how much they're going to give you. So maybe they're just going to give you $2 and they're proposing to keep the remaining $8. Now you've got a choice. You can either take those $2 and leave and spend it, and that's real money in your pocket, or you can say, no, I'm not taking that. And if you say no, then you don't get any money, but neither does the other player. So you've acted in a way that's made you both lose. So technically, you've acted spitefully. And that's kind of one of the core ways that particularly economists measure spite.
And economists, you write, were surprised by this, because if I'm the guy getting the $2, you know, yeah, maybe it's not fair, but this decision I make means I'm out the $2 or $20. The numbers change. The stakes get higher or lower. This seems to be contrary to what we'd expect from strictly economically maximizing humans, right?
Yeah, you think, again, from a kind of classical economics point of view, right. $2 is better than no dollars. So in theory, you should just take the money and be glad with your $2. And that's what many economists thought would happen. It turned out they were right, but just about the wrong species. Because if you get chimpanzees to play the game using raisins, then the chimps will take any raisins you give them. Then they're not fussy. They're not proud. They'll take those 2 raisins out of 10 and walk away and eat them. But we tend to behave quite differently.
And there's at heart of this maybe a sense of justice. And that points toward one potential benefit. If I'm dividing up resources and I know that somebody can blow up the whole deal, I'm motivated to be more fair. And this might be why spite survived evolutionarily.
Absolutely. Fairness does seem to play a key role. So again, if you feel that you're being treated unfairly, or the other person is getting ahead undeservingly, then you'll turn around and spite them, because the unfairness has triggered anger in you. It's triggered disgust. So when you look at people's faces when they're offered only $2, you see a typical pattern of muscle movements, which is associated with disgust. That anger and that disgust fuse together to form moral outrage, and you spite them. But what's kind of interesting is that, you know, normally we would be quite empathic creatures, so we wouldn't want to hurt somebody else because we'd feel their pain too. So normally empathy would stop you punishing the other person, or at least maybe deter you from it. But it turns out that if we see somebody else acting unfairly, then neuroimaging studies have shown that we tend, when looking at that unfair person's face, not to process it like we would process a normal face. We process it more like any other object. So literally, if somebody acts unfairly, our brains make them appear less human to us. which in turn then allows us to punish them.
Talking to Simon McCarthy Jones, author of the book Spite, The Upside of Your Dark Side. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology and a neuropsychologist at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. All right, Simon, I pointed us toward the upside of spite there a little bit. It could be that we are trying to seek justice to prevent unfairness by behaving spitefully. But as you write, that's not the only thing that leads us to spitefulness. Sometimes it's coming from, I think what most people would agree would be negative places. Can you talk about that kind of spite?
Yeah, so it makes our species look good when we think, well, we'll spite fairness and that's why we do it. But there is a darker side. So if you give people the chance to spite somebody who's just fairly earned money on one of these economic games, then you'll find that if everyone can see what they're doing, they won't spitefully try and harm somebody who's fairly earned money and got ahead. But if you kind of give them the blanket of anonymity and allow them to kind of harm the other person in the dark, then you find that maybe around 40% of people will spite somebody and take money away if you give them a chance from somebody who's earned that money fairly. So even being fair doesn't necessarily harm you from spite. And things maybe get even worse. So it's been found that even if somebody is nice to you, helps you out, you can still turn around and spite them. This is called do-gooder derogation. And this seems to arise because if somebody is nice to us and other people can see that, then they get social brownie points for being nice. Other people think, oh, that's a nice person, I might want to work with them. And you see that happening, you think, right, I need to bring that person down because I don't want them to look better than I do. So even if somebody fairly gets an advantage, or even if someone tries to help us, we can still turn around and spite them.
It's something that you keep coming back to in the book that I think says a lot about us as humans. Sometimes we're motivated not just by our personal gain or loss in life, but our relative status, whether we're measuring it in points or money, or as you said, those social brownie points. We want to make sure we are relatively in a better position to another person. I'm not explaining that well. I think you could probably do a little better.
No, I think you're explaining it well. So psychologists would call that positional bias. So if you give folks the option between, you can have a salary, say, of 100 grand a year, and your neighbor can earn, say, 90 grand, so slightly less than you. Now, would you be happy with that? Or would you like to switch? So we'll now pay you a bit extra. We'll give you 110 grand a year, but we're also going to give your neighbor 120 grand. So now you're earning more, but your neighbor's earning more than you. So do you prefer to be earning the most you possibly could, or would you rather earn slightly less and be ahead of your neighbour? And you find a pile of people would much prefer to have slightly less, but to be ahead of their neighbour.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. So I'm driving down the highway, and I may be in a 70-mile-an-hour zone in the left lane, because the guy in the right lane is going 65. The guy behind me in the left lane is going 75, 78, 79, and he's on my bumper. And I refuse to go over the lane because I'm going faster than the guy in the slow lane. Is that mean?
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And Mark bringing up, I think, a pretty classic experiment in spite, driving on American roadways, Simon. How could you talk about how our concepts of spite might apply to a driver in that situation? That guy's going too slow and that annoys me. That guy's going too fast. I'm not going to let him pass me.
I guess it's, what are you in those situations? What are you thinking the other person's intentions are? So that person's on your tail. Do you feel that they're acting unfairly by trying to get ahead of you, that the limits don't apply to them, that somehow they think that they're maybe superior to you, they're more important to you? And those kind of social valuations, again, trigger this kind of response in us, which makes us want to kind of bring that person down. So I guess in a way, this kind of goes back to our lives many thousands of years ago when we were hunter-gatherers. So if you look at hunter-gatherers today, you find when the anthropologists do the work that they tend to live in quite egalitarian societies, well, at least in terms of how men treat men. So in those societies, if somebody does something great, then the rest of the group don't applaud them. They try and drag them down. So if somebody brought home, I don't know, a whole mammoth for dinner, that person wouldn't get applauded. They get castigated because they're starting to look like they're better than everybody else. So in that society, we seem to have evolved kind of this pulling down instinct, where if anybody tries to get ahead or look superior, we will pull them down quite happily.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Simon McCarthy Jones, author of the book Spite, The Upside of Your Dark Side. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd care to share, is there a situation that brings out your own spite? Do you feel good after you do something spiteful, or do you feel bad or embarrassed? And do you have questions about the psychology of spitefulness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the book Spite, The Upside of Your Dark Side. Simon McCarthy Jones stays with us, author and neuropsychologist at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Peter is with us in Summers. Peter, hi.
Hello there. What a fascinating topic. First, I have a comment. The example that you used about someone speeding up to cut you off from getting in their lane. Now, that's a perfect example of spite. And as a commuter myself, I see it on a daily basis. But I just wanted to make a comment that in Germany, if you do that, that's illegal. And a police officer can and will pull you over and give you a big ticket. So you are obligated to let someone into your lane. So again, a difference in cultural values, shifting from society to society. So I'm wondering, okay, so that takes care of the comment. My question is, I'm having a little bit of a difficult time wrapping my head around what the thesis is, because I'm a little bit confused. Because if we're talking about now being primates, we have certain characteristics that we shared in our evolutionary past, which conferred an advantage upon us. For instance, killing a rival's offspring. We don't do that as human beings anymore, because whatever tome you go to discern what a well-adjusted person is, whether it's the DSM-5, the Holy Bible, the Quran, I think we could agree as reasonable people that these vestiges of our primate past no longer serve us in a society. So I guess I'm having a hard time understanding what the author's thesis is, because he says there is an upside to this. And again, I'm not really hearing it, because I'll stop there.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Gave us a lot to work with. So I guess our evolutionary biology generating spite versus our upbringings, our well-adjusted personalities turning us away from spite. Simon, how do you split the difference?
That's a good question from Peter. There's a lot to be said there. So first of all, I suppose you could ask, like, are we maybe less spiteful than our ancestors? So there's some nice work by an anthropologist called Richard Wrangham, who basically argues that over time, we as humans have basically domesticated ourselves, in that we've rewarded people who were less violent, were less spiteful, and that over time, we've actually become a much less violent creature. So that's kind of a view over time. In terms of the how spite manifests today, it seems because we've built institutions to do punishment, we've taken it out of the hands of individuals. There's kind of less of a need for individual spite because our institutions hand out punishment, which stops, you know, the Hatfield versus McCoy vendettas getting going. So we seem to have developed institutions which have kind of reined in our need to spite. And similarly, so I mentioned earlier this tendency we have to punish people who are generous to us, do good at derogation. You tend to find that kind of spite is much more prevalent in countries where the rule of law has really kind of has been diminished. So when we have law, we seem to be able to kind of minimize the amount of spite we have.
And Peter also brought up cultural differences. He gave a case of a legal difference in Germany, but you write that spite can work differently from culture to culture. Even that ultimatum game we talked about where people divvy up money, one society might do it very differently than others. What kind of differences do we see?
Sure. So an anthropologist called Joe Henrichs does some really nice work on this. He's kind of played the ultimatum game all over the world. And so, for example, when he played it with indigenous people in Peru, just near Machu Picchu, he found that basically nearly nobody turned down low offers. So even if people were offered a pittance, a couple of bucks, they would still take it. And it seems that was the case because in their culture, sharing was the norm. And so there wasn't the usual need to punish people. So they didn't feel the need to punish people. Similarly, or conversely, when he played the game with the Hazara people in Tanzania, he found that nearly everybody turned down an offer of about $2 out of $10. And that seems to be because in their culture, sharing really wasn't a thing. They viewed sharing as basically tolerated theft. And so in their society, there was this really strong punishment culture if somebody acted unfairly, and therefore that got deployed during the game. So yeah, we do see this variation around the world according to your norms of fairness in your society.
Thanks a lot for that call, Peter. We'll go to Mary next in St. Charles, Illinois. Mary, hello.
Hi, how are you? So I have a question about directing healthy versus unhealthy fight or competition in your children. My children both, one plays piano pretty well. She's been playing for years. Her younger brother is now taking up piano, and they are always and forever in competition in a way that is not productive. They will put each other down when the other one does something wrong. And I definitely have the feeling that they're trying to get a leg up in getting my praise or getting an adult's attention, but it's not a productive way to do that. Is there a way to direct our natural instincts for this stuff to be a more productive kind of a competition where it's not so negative?
Mary, thanks for the call. Simon, I don't know if you have specific parenting advice. What are your thoughts on that competitive spite among a couple of kids here?
Oh, I'm not going near parenting advice. but what I will say is that, so one little kind of fable I came across was a story about an American and a Russian who both have a neighbor who's got a prize winning cow. And the American thinks, right, my neighbor's got a prize winning cow. I'm going to work my backside off so I can get a prize winning cow just like him. Whereas the Russian just goes around to the neighbors and shoots the cow. So the question is, how do we respond to other people's achievements? Do we try and excel, which I think, frankly, is kind of part of the American way, or do we have a culture where we just try and pull the other person down? So maybe it's trying to modify our reactions, trying to manage our anger in order to try and push ourselves to use that other person's achievement as an inspiration rather than as something to be torn down.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Simon, in our last minute or so, can you talk about, just having gone through this experience of writing about spite and analyzing it, what can we take home as we try to figure out when we're being spiteful and how to do it maybe in a less negative way?
Sure. So back in ancient Greece, Aristotle talked about how, say for anger, there was praise for somebody who got angry at the right time, in the right way, and for the right amount of time. I think with spite, if we can understand our spiteful side, then we can control it much better. So we don't have that hand of evolution kind of pushing us in the small of the back to do things that evolution might want us to do, but we don't. So I think by understanding spite, by understanding what triggers spite in us, and by understanding how we control emotions such as anger, we can kind of regain autonomy and decide how we want to act and let that guide us rather than the fickle hand of evolution.
We'll leave it there. Simon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure.
That was Simon McCarthy-Jones, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology and a neuropsychologist at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. He joined us today to talk about his book. It's called Spite, The Upside of Your Dark Side. Still time for you to share your stories and maybe your observations about spite, or maybe a way that you found you were a little spiteful in life and found a way to get over it. I actually just gave up a long-term unannounced boycott of a coffee shop that did me wrong one time, and I'm glad I did it. I feel better. Maybe you have, maybe you've overcome spitefulness in your own way, big or small. Email us, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org, and share your story. Or you can always tweet us, @CentralTimeWPR. Love to hear what you have to say about spite in your life. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report rates the air quality here in Wisconsin. We'll check out the results from the American Lung Association. There are some bright spots where we look pretty good compared to the rest of the country. There is room for improvement in certain kinds of pollution and in certain places around the state. And should the federal government provide incentives to allow parents to stay home and parent? We'll look at the long-running question and the latest in federal relief packages. You can join in with your thoughts. That's tomorrow on Central Time. on Food Friday last week. Our guest shared great ingredients for making tea that we can grow at home. But one of you stumped her. A caller brought up memories of drinking tea made from pine needles. Our guest didn't know about that. Neither did I, by the way. But a lot of you did. A quick thought before you try this at home. An internet search suggests that there are some evergreen needles that are toxic to humans. So do some research and know your source before you make pine tea at home. All right, now here are some of the emails you sent about pine needle tea. Kelly says white pine, Pinus strobus, needles make a good tea. And when the needles are young, they also make a good pesto. Seems like it'd still be pokey, but that's just me. Jenny in Lake Geneva says, this is a blast from the past. We used to make a yummy tea with white pine needles and the red fruit from staghorn sumac. It would make a bright red and fruity tea. I'm going to have to do this, Jenny says, with my kids this summer. Henry writes, wintergreen berries and white pine needles and a little honey makes an absolutely amazing Northwoods style tea. And Joan Rodas, Joan says, I used to work at Hunt Hill Audubon Sanctuary. Survival classes were very popular. I introduced pine needle tea with who'd like to see a survival plant that's actually saved lives. Apparently, pine needles high in vitamin C, and the French explorer Cartier saved his men from scurvy. A local Native American chief's son actually did it when he showed Cartier pine needles and saved them from death by scurvy. A noble history of pine needle tea. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.